So welcome everyone to the launch of Queer Beyond London and to a debate about LGBTQ community and local history. My name is Matt Cook and this is Alison Oren. We've been working together on the project. We've got a pretty full hour ahead. First of all, I'm going to talk for about 5 minutes just outlining what we were aiming to do on the project. Alison's going to do another 5 minutes talking about what we found out. I'm going to hand over to Justin Bengry, who is our researcher on the project, to chair a panel discussion about LGBTQ local and community history with our panel of Jeffrey, Rachel, and EJ, who he'll introduce more formally momentarily. And then we'll have a discussion and questions from the floor, and then Alison and I will pop up again at the end with any final thoughts about what all this might mean for the future in terms of community history projects and how we might support and facilitate them. So the first thing I wanted to do was to congratulate LGBT History Month. Over the last 15 years, they've helped to create an environment and an appetite for LGBTQ history and history making locally and nationally. And it's part of what prompted the questions we wanted to ask and address for this project. So when Alison and I first talked about Queer Beyond London, which was called Sexualities and Localities back then, we observed two things in particular. In terms of what had been published, we saw often sweeping histories which tended to be London-centric. We also noted that often with Heritage Lottery Fund backing, there was yet a profusion of local and community LGBT history projects, in fact, about 60 since 2002, suggesting a plethora of other ways of thinking about the LGBTQ past. And of course, these have often been showcased in Lesbian and Gay History Month. So we wanted to know how LGBTQ history in or of Britain looks when we start with those local rather than national or metropolitan, rather than with a national or metropolitan focus. We didn't want to assume that those national landmarks, dates, people and events had the same even impact in different parts of the country. We wanted to know what difference geography, city size, local economy, local government and policing, and distance from London made to LGBTQ life and experience in the cities we chose. And we wanted to understand that by looking comparatively. So we chose Manchester, Leeds, Brighton, and Plymouth because precisely of their differences from each other, and also because of the local community history projects that had already been undertaken in these places and which allowed us access to incredibly rich primary source material. And these included in Brighton, Brighton Transformed, Queer in Brighton, and Brighton Our Story, which was one of the pioneering oral history projects started in the late 1980s. In Plymouth, we had the incredible Pride in Our Past oral history project. In Manchester, we had This Is How We Got Here, about the Lesbian and Gay Centre, and Queer Noise, which looked really innovatively at the importance of music and clubbing to LGBTQ life and experience. In Leeds, we had the LGBTQ project, the Lesbian Identity project, and oral histories associated with the Feminist Archive North, and much more besides. We gathered our ideas together and put in an application to the Arts and Humanities Research Council, which, when it succeeded, allowed us to employ Justin, who's been fantastic. He spent a year charting the available material in each of these places and helped us to conduct workshops, witness seminars, and further interviews in each place, hosted and facilitated by project partners, the Brighton Museum and Sussex's Keep Archive, the Leeds Museum and the West Yorkshire Archives, the Manchester People's History Museum and Lesbian and Gay Centre, Plymouth Library and Archive, and here in London, the London Metropolitan Archive, who didn't seem to mind that we weren't talking about London. We held a conference bringing together a wide range of people working on LGBTQ local histories, nationally and internationally, and then we went quiet. Processing all this and writing, passing drafts to people from each of our case study cities for their input. So we wanted to keep that conversation going as we wrote our drafts. So what's coming up is a book which myself and Alison are co-authoring called Queer Beyond London, a collection of essays by 14 different authors emerging from that conference and covering places across the whole country, a queer scrapbook of sources with commentaries and input from around 25 people, again from right across the country, and perhaps more broadly but less tangibly, those highlights of LGBTQ collections that have been brought into conversation with each other through the work we've done. What I've really loved about this project is the collaborative spirit that I've encountered, and the sense of people coming to it from different places and directions. So just immediately in the project team, Alison is from Leeds Beckett University, I'm from Birkbeck, just down the road. Justin came to us from California and is now at Goldsmiths. He's the glamorous one. Jaya Rathbone and Grace Oakley joined us for a period of work experience from Stoke Newington School in Hackney. The home of the project has been the Raphael Samuel History Centre, where our wonderful administrator, Katie Pettit, is based, and which is part sponsoring this evening's event. Raphael Samuel, after whom the centre was named, was a pioneering social and public historian who died in 1996. He wrote that history was too important to be left only to professional historians, and was the work of many hands and the accumulation of many voices. For me, Queer Beyond London has underlined his philosophy and mission. We would have got nowhere without the warm and generous support of our partners and collaborators in each city and beyond, and indeed including the people on our panel this evening. And of course, the British Library and the LGBTQ plus network here are hosting and supporting us this evening. Without these people and organisations, there would simply have been no project. And without the dozens of testimonies, those voices on which our published work is based, the project would have no heart. For a sense of what we learnt from them, I'm going to pass you to Alison.
Thanks, Matt. And can I just say that I want to second Matt's thanks to the British Library, to LGBT History Month, and to all our partners. So, what's distinctive about the histories of our four queer cities? I'm going to talk a bit about each of them, but obviously it's very a brief glimpse, really. Brighton. Brighton already had a national reputation as a lesbian and gay party town by the 1960s, with the highest density of gay pubs and clubs per head of population amongst all our four cities. Promising the sexual freedom of the seaside, whether just for the weekend or more permanently, its alternative queer ambiance was strengthened from the 60s by its arts festival and the establishment of Sussex University. Brighton's economy, based on service industries and small businesses, also contributes to its queer character. Its ethos of individuality, linked to the sense of freedom to recreate oneself in playful, performative, and queer ways. Meanwhile, Manchester has been in the vanguard of LGBT politics. It was the birthplace of the radical branch of the law reform movement, which became the Campaign for Homosexual Equality. From the late 60s, Manchester activists lobbied their MPs and their councils and in all the towns around and held public meetings to demand change. Actions of considerable bravery in the context of the time when gay men and lesbians were stigmatised and marginalised. And in Manchester more recently, the sustained support of the City Council since 1984 for its lesbian and gay citizens has become interwoven into Manchester's sense of a queer civic pride. Not coincidentally, Manchester and Brighton both had flourishing cultures of music, media, and the arts, which fostered their development as queer cities. And of course, still today, both places have a reputation for queer hedonism. Brighton's more bohemian, Manchester's more raucous, pace-setting, and larger scale. Manchester's Queer Up North Festival was the first of its kind in the country from 1992, but was long predated by its club and drag scene. But all our four cities had an active, if sometimes semi-hidden, gay scene. Gay men in Leeds described certain pubs and coffee bars, as well as the steam baths, that formed a circuit of sexual potential in the city centre. Leeds comes to the fore as well for its highly active lesbian feminist culture in the late 1970s. In the context of the Yorkshire Ripper murders between 1975 and 1980, some Leeds lesbians sharpened lesbian separatism into a theory of revolutionary feminism, which provoked debate throughout the country. So into the 1980s, Leeds was the most overtly gender-divided queer city in our sample. At least that's certainly what comes out from the existing material. In Plymouth, the gay scene was more fluid. There were pubs and bars where gay men might hook up with supposedly straight sailors right through to the 1990s, and several lesbian venues a little further from the centre. Now, Plymouth's interesting. It's a post-war planned city, that is to say, planned for family life, heteronormative family life. And of course, it's a major military, naval city. So it has a culture that values tradition. Same-sex relationships in the military remained illegal until as recently as the year 2000. But while this dampened down expressions of gay, civic, or urban pride, Plymouth still had an active LGBT community. Indeed, in 1981, a lesbian couple moved there from Manchester to start a radical and gay-friendly bookshop named In Other Words. So showing sort of some patterns of migration between our cities that completely bypass London. So LGBT people in Plymouth were not in the closet, but they took pride in passing below the radar, to use their own military analogy, and on integrating with the dominant culture. The pattern of everyday queer life changed less rapidly here than in the other cities. It was a vicious homophobic murder in Plymouth Central Park in 1995 that galvanised the LGBT community to put their heads above the parapet and work subsequently and successfully with the police and local authorities. The HIV and AIDS crisis from the mid-80s affected all four cities, and especially Brighton, which led the way nationally in its community response. And activism against Section 28 in the same period brought previously segregated lesbian, gay, bi and trans groups together in Manchester, Leeds and Brighton. So, I mean, clearly I've not done these cities justice, and apologies for any kind of, reinforcing of assumptions about them. But it's really interesting once you start sort of looking into the detail. So this quick fire tour of the four cities isn't intended as a competition for who's the queerest of them all, but to show that there are very different histories and expressions of queer urban pride. Differences between the north and the south, differences between west and east along the south coast. And the community history collections that we drew on are, as well as histories of events, they are archives of feelings through which people weigh up the queer past against the present day normalisation, or the term that Steve used earlier, usualisation of LGBTQ lives from the period of civil partnerships onwards. So gentrification in Manchester and Brighton has led to some feelings of loss of the queer feel of the city centre. In Plymouth, there are feelings of nostalgia for the neighbourly gay pubs and clubs that are remembered from the 80s. However, it's the gains that are stressed in the interviews which look at the changes over time, and a welcome, certainly, for this new ordinariness of the past 10 to 15 years. So, to continue the discussion about community LGBTQ history, which is we've started to open up, I'm going to hand over now to Justin and our panel speakers.
Thanks so much, Alison.
I'm really delighted to be joined on stage by three people who've done such important and innovative work in and supporting LGBTQ histories for quite some time. And we're going to have a conversation about the problems and the challenges and the opportunities of queer community history work, issues about who gets represented there, funding issues, and connections between academic historical work, institutions like museums, and LGBTQ organizations themselves. So it's going to be relatively wide-ranging. I'm going to introduce all three of the speakers right away, and each will have 5 minutes to discuss their points, and then we'll return back for a conversation before involving everyone else in a Q&A. Jeffrey Weeks has been for decades one of the leading historians of the LGBTQ past and is the author of numerous books on LGBTQ and sexual history, as well as being emeritus professor of sociology at London South Bank University. Rachel Hasted has worked in museums, archives, and built heritage since the 1970s, often in roles aimed at diversifying participation. Rachel is currently a member of the Heritage Lottery Fund Regional Committee for London. And E.J. Scott is a queer curator, dress historian, Ducky's archival researcher, and founder of the Museum of Transology, in addition to about 50 other things. if you'd start us off, please, Jeffrey.
Thanks very much, Justin. Well, first of all, let me say what a pleasure it is to be here and to welcome the project that we're discussing tonight. I've read a little of the findings, and I think it's going to be earth-shattering in many ways in changing our perceptions of LGBT life in Britain. And I welcome that very, very much indeed. Compared to the dearth when I began writing about LGBT history in the 70s, today it's a mountain or a forest of wonderful stuff. But I think that work like this raises all sorts of interesting questions. And in particular, the one I want to focus on is the relationship between the local and the national and international. In other words, how we can see the relationship of the local to the broader social trends. Because I think it's absolutely vital that we look at everything within its particular context. And the work that's being done there is really innovative. And yet there are commonalities. So what's the nature of those commonalities? I think LGBT history is more than simply an agglomeration of separate local histories. There's something wider going on, and yet the wider things can't explain the local histories. So it's a paradox to me that I think it's important to explore. So I want to make three simple points. At least I hope they're simple. The first is about myself, in a way. I was born in South Wales, in a mining village in South Wales. So my first experience of queer life was as an adolescent in the valleys. And I gave a paper last year in Cardiff in History Month. And it was titled Queer Boy from the Valleys. Mm-hmm. And it was about me, but it was also an attempt to relate it to wider social trends. I then escaped to London. I came to London as a student and have stayed in London ever since. And most of my adult experiences have been as a metropolitan liver, dweller. And certainly I've imbibed all the metropolitan valleys of being queer in London. And yet, constantly, especially as I grow older, I'm thinking of that relationship between the boy who grew up in a completely homophobic society and a highly gendered society, which I couldn't relate to, and the sort of life I'd led in London, and wondered how much of that is in me and how much of me now relates to everything that's changed in the valleys. And that sort of dialectic, I think, has shaped my life. Even when I thought I'd escaped it, I haven't escaped it. So my roots are still very much there in the Welsh valleys. And the older I get, the more I reflect on that and realize I haven't escaped all my experiences then, despite everything that's happened since. Now, there's a lot of interesting work that, in a sense, reflects on the national and the local at the same time. And I particularly want to mention today, because we've just launched History Month, the work of Jeff Evans, who's been the great inspirer of History Month, because he's done a very interesting study of the rate and rhythms of prosecutions for what we now call homosexual offences in Lancashire from the early 19th century. And what that work does is to sort of undermine the assumptions which would come too readily from a reading of prosecutions and the legal framework in London. And it forces you to think about regional differences, about local differences, and what they mean. Again, recent work in South Wales, where I come from, has shown that despite the homophobia, the rate of prosecutions in South Wales in the 20th century was actually relatively low. And yet, at the same time, I experienced the pressure of a quite conformist sexual culture. So sexual cultures are different. And yet, at the same time, obviously, the legal framework was similar, identical. And what you could see working through Jeff's work in Lancashire is the differential impact of the sodomy law and then the buggery laws and then of the Labouchere Amendment, but working in a different way and changing over time from what we knew in the earlier histories of London. So that's my first point. About the differential, the different patterns. Second point is about the overall pattern of LGBT history over the 30, 40 years it existed in this country. And I want to suggest there are three distinct moments in those histories which necessarily reflect back on the local history, local histories. And just to summarise very briefly, I think the first moment is very much about the construction of an overall narrative that was inevitably based on the most obvious sources, especially the London sources. It derived from our knowledge of the legal system, the medicalisation pattern and so on, and the acts of resistance that began to create the LGBT communities as we know them from the 19th century onwards. The second moment was an attempt to deconstruct that, to actually look at the categories, especially of gender and sexuality, and to see them as historical constructs and as, in a sense, constraints on the diversity and variety of practice. The third moment is our increasing recognition over this time of diversity, ethnic, geographical, gendered, and particularly in recent years, the fact of gender diversity, gender variation, in a sense forgotten by historians until recently, and yet nevertheless a crucial part of that history. The moment of diversity, I think, is the one that has directed us most obviously to the local, to the regional. But as the work of Alison and Matt, I think, will show, nevertheless, despite those diversities and those variations, in fact, we can see the macro tendencies, especially obviously, most obviously, the legal changes, but also the wider changes in the economy, society, family, diversity, and so on, growing. The crucial point about that is you can't separate LGBT queer history from the wider social trends. You can't understand everything that's happened in the last 40 years if you ignore those wider trends. And I just name one example, the example particularly of identity. There's been lots of debate about how important gay identity has been, whether the histories of identity formation have squashed diversity and so on. And yet the whole importance of identity is that it wasn't simply an LGBT phenomenon. Since the 1950s, it's been a major issue from youth identities through the identities of women, ethnic and racial identities and so on. Identity has been a crucial issue from the early 50s. Today, I think that's more widely recognized because everyone complains about the dominance of identity politics. Mm. But my argument would be that identity is always absolutely critical to any political awareness. Everything is about identity, from class identity onwards. There are different identities. And I think what our attempts at histories of LGBT identities has done is not simply to show the formation of identities we're familiar with today, but to see it again as part of a wider social development and social trend. And I think that's vitally important. And briefly, because I'm overrunning my time, I think the third thing that's really important about the local, regional histories that are now being done, but it's also been important since the 70s with the emergence of LGBT history, is what they're about. It's not simply an archaic attempt to expand the range of history. It is actually about recovering a past. It's about recovering memory, and it's about recovering voice. I'll put it another way, it's about making memory part of our identities, and it's about giving voice to different identities. And that returns us to, I think, what's absolutely central about queer history. It is, in the end, about the way communities construct their sense of themselves in the circumstances they find themselves, in the circumstances of historic diversity between different nations and regions and localities of these islands, and also within the macro tendencies which have changed everyone's life over the last 50, 60 years. So what connects us? What connects us isn't simply sexual taste, because we've got different sexual tastes. It's not simply gender, because there are a variety of different gender identities and gender aspirations. It's about imaginative links with people we think are like us and people we think are different from us. Like us doesn't mean we're identical. On the contrary, we're realizing we're all different. And yet, those of us who identify as LGBTQ plus are actually making a leap to see ourselves as part of a wider history. And I think that leap is something that is enacted through a variety of different sorts of history, whether national, international, or local.
Thank you for that, Jeffrey, which I think really sets up Rachel and EJ quite well. If you would continue for us, Rachel.
Gosh, I'm going to take a completely different tack now, though tremendous number of wonderful things there that I'm sure we're all going to pick up on later, and just say a few things in 5 minutes. And I have to tell you that speaking for 5 minutes is torture, but I will try. About lottery funding and the impact that may have had on projects that set out to document and raise awareness of queer history, and to raise a couple of concerns that I have about the long-term future of that work. As it's been said, I'm currently on the London Regional Committee for HLF, helping to say who gets the money, which is fun. and I am not here as a spokesperson for them tonight, but I have checked my facts with them, and I will very happily report back any points that may be helpful to their thinking in the future. Please forgive me for reading some of this, but there are a number of facts and figures that I ought to get right, and my aging brain will not do it unaided. I wanted to point out that HLF was actually started in 1994, and that was the same year in which Gabrielle Bourne, who some of you may know her work, undertook a survey of 20 British social history museums to ask what lesbian and gay material they held. Only five were actively collecting, three London boroughs, Glasgow and Stoke-on-Trent. And 6 years later, Angela Vanegas repeated the survey and found very little change. And for those of you who want to look it up, it's all published by Angela Vanegas in Richard Sandel's Museum, Society and Inequality. I think that's really interesting that that was the year that the lottery started work. And it didn't do much to start with. But since then, national lottery players have enabled the Heritage Lottery spend to invest £7.7 billion mm-hmm. into over 42,000 projects sharing, saving and celebrating the UK's heritage. Now, HLF does not prescribe what heritage is. It asks applicants to say what they value and want to share. As a funder, it does seek to promote equal access to funding for all parts of the community. Everyone plays the lottery. And they look geographically, economically, and socially to see there's a fair split. It does therefore prioritise some underrepresented aspects of heritage, and sexual orientation and gender identity are among those. So, okay, since 1994, HLF has awarded £5.4 million to over 130 projects that have set out specifically to explore the heritage of LGBT plus communities in the UK. Now, that sounds really great, doesn't it? 5.4 million out of 7.7 billion. Mm-hmm. 130 projects out of 42,000 projects. Okay. I know that the HLF development teams in different regions work really hard to encourage groups and networks to apply for funding. And I know we've got representatives of some successful projects here who've had that funding. But please do get in touch with them if you have an idea for a project that you want to make happen. So what kinds of projects do get funded? So far, the great majority of projects around queer histories supported by HLF have been at the lower end of the grant requests, ranging from a couple of thousand pounds up to about 400,000. Smaller projects often tend to be more local in scope, so that's something that's affecting the kind of public history that we're getting. And that, in turn, reflects both the voluntary and community sector context within which the majority of LGBT volunteer-led activities work. So this is projects that are being pushed up from the community rather than large organisations that are coming forward saying, we don't know enough about this, we should collect more, we should do more. And also the regional development team structure at HLF, which is focused on particular areas. There's a lot of focus at the moment on securing heritage which is at risk. Particularly where an older generation may be looking to deposit material or stories are in danger of being lost before my generation die. So that's driving some projects. And more recently, there have been interesting projects coming forward looking at the intersectionality between gender, sexuality, faith and age, such as Rainbow Pilgrims and Rainbow Jews. HLF tell me that they've only very recently started having conversations which take a wider overview. They've seen a few projects which take a longer historical perspective on LGBTQ heritage and would welcome more of those. And they've not yet had an application for a national project in this area. Trail. Okay, what concerns have I got before I wrap up? The first one is about long-term survival and access to project records. Lottery funding is by its very nature temporary. Projects are limited to a maximum of 5 years. HLF asks for plans that show how the project outcomes will be kept safe and available beyond the end of the work. And in the case of larger grants, recipients will have a longer-term contract to keep websites up and going and so on. Generating and sharing records of our experience is in itself a powerful thing, as Geoffrey's been saying, but embedding those into the historical record and ensuring that researchers can continue to access them will be crucial. Many groups have experienced how easy it is to be picked up by cultural organisations as the current fashionable thing, only to find that amnesia closes in over their existence a few years later. We live in tough times. I know how many requests I used to receive as the manager of local museums and archives to agree to be the repository for HLF project records. Now, those very archives and museums are often under threat themselves and have seen major cuts in their capacity already. So how good is the long-term access to this material going to be? Is it time for a health check? And secondly, embedding long-term commitment to fair representation in the core work of the heritage sector. Okay, this is where I get the knives out. And it's lovely to see museum people here tonight. But I think it's past time for the heritage sector as a whole, rather than individual institutions, to understand that there has for some time been a developing body of expert research and theory on the history of sexuality and gender, which is central to the knowledge base of museums, archives, and the built heritage. I pay huge respect to institutions like the London Metropolitan Archives and the British Museum, who have seriously taken this approach for years now. And these are organisations at home with both academic researchers and a wider public, and who understand this work as part of their core skills and knowledge. And without embarrassing Alison Oram, Matt Cook, and the other contributors who work with my ex-colleague Rosie Sherrington at Historic England to deliver the project, I would want to point to Pride of Place, the website, England's LGBTQ heritage, as an example of embedding queer histories in the core work of an institution which was not previously known for its radical approach. And I speak as the diversity manager there for 7 years. It was funded from the core research budget of Historic England to answer questions where they had identified a lack of internal expertise, not in this case dependent on the lottery. Ensuring that the research for the website and crowdsourced history pin map actively linked to the formal designation listing process for historic buildings, which requires government ministerial consent to change once it's done, has been a huge shift in attitude to the importance of this history. And again, it was that link between high standards of academic scholarship and the ability of a heritage organisation to promote that work more widely in public life, which has helped to move things forward. However, in general, I believe that too much of this work in the sector still rests on the shoulders of individual staff, and there's always a danger that when they leave, that learning is lost. Real long-term institutional change has to be modelled from the top and embodied in core values. Perhaps funders have a role in looking at the longer track record of heritage bodies and whether individual projects are building towards that change over time. And I'd like to finish by quoting Professor Richard Sandel. I'm not really trying to push his books, but he has a blog which he was invited to write on the HLF website on the 2017 anniversary of partial decriminalisation, which is really worth reading. And at the end he says, perhaps most importantly, the work that we do in this area can be understood not as bolt-on, project-based and fleeting, but as a core part of our thinking and practice in the heritage sector. And I think that's what we need to require now of publicly funded heritage. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Rachel. It's delightful too to hear a name call to Pride of Place. But also really interesting to hear those figures are astonishing. That was really, really valuable information. And of course, the HLF-funded projects were integral to Queer Beyond London as well. Mm-hmm. To you, EJ.
Well, it segues quite nicely because I thought I would put my West Yorkshire Queer Stories cap on and talk about an HLF-funded project. West Yorkshire Queer Stories is based in the MESMAC offices in Leeds, Bradford and Wakefield, one of the largest sexual health organisations in the country, and we're in partnership with Leeds City Museum and West Yorkshire Archives. And put simply, the project is trying to do what it says on the tin. We're recording stories, testimonies across the region. It's extremely ambitious. So we are aiming to record 150 contributions from at least 190 people, 30 whole life stories, 110 individual contributions and 10 group recordings. And we have key curatorial strands that keep us committed to our ideas surrounding good practice. This is health and disabilities, trans lives and BAME testimonies. Outputs, loads of them. Short films, sexy website, museum takeover for LGBT History Month in Leeds, commissioning artists to make new works, and more, many more. Our fundamental interpretation of the 18-page bid plan, did I say it was ambitious? Is that we go by the rule of the three C's, that we are to collect, curate, and conserve. And the curating part's a fundamental part of it because I'm very interested about getting the information out. And at the heart of the Social History Project is our core team of 50 community curators who are all trained to go out there and do everything from record oral testimonies to put on events. So it's about the community by the community, and it's a lot. I mean, it's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of material. So it's more than anyone could possibly listen to. And I guess this brings me to my first question, and that's, who are we talking to with our queer history caps on? So are we talking to the local LGBTIQ plus communities to help them know more about each other and their community and to increase connectivity? Or are we talking to the broader straight audience in a bid to strengthen community cohesion and teach them about the diversity in their communities? Or are we talking to other international and national queer communities as a way to strengthen our own queer cultural ties? And I guess my worry is, if the material remains entirely introspective, then we're at risk of queer history becoming as marginalised as the communities that produce it. So it will make an excellent box set. It'd be like, The Cult of Queer History. So these forces of marginalisation combine with the ideas, the limitations of oral testimonies as well. It's a solo pursuit, after all. You can't listen and talk at the same time, no matter how much gay gene you've got in you, right? And we've also got the fact that the digital media really has killed the radio star. So people don't, they're demanding in museums more and more for the digital content rather than standing with headphones on and listening. And in fact, at Brighton Museum not so long ago, I saw some kids trying to swipe the text panels, which makes me want to give up on life. I guess the antidote to these kind of challenges are the absolute potential of queer creativity. So I was very worried about people not listening to the oral histories and not going out to West Yorkshire Archives and putting on the headphones. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? So what we're going to do is we're going to have a silent disco, and we're all going to put on our headphones, and we're all going to dance in public and own the space, but we only know what's going on with each other. And so there's that sort of that building of that queer tension. And then we will, you know, hear grabs of the oral histories, and we'll be like, yeah, you know, I used to have sex in those toilets in the 80s, and then we'll be like, George Michael, freedom. So it'd be cool. But then we've got very humble ideas, like I've got my community workers here today. They're the ground team, Ross and Rachel. And Rachel came up with this beautiful idea of just literally printing out some of the stories and cutting up little snippets and putting them in envelopes and just handing them out to people at events, so you get your little queer story to take home. So really wonderful creative solutions. But I've got another even bigger question that I hope maybe we can talk about tonight. And I find it complex to think about and tricky to talk about. And it came up when the West Yorkshire Queer Stories team said that they're frequently asked in training sessions of the volunteers, what does it mean to be from West Yorkshire? Does it mean you have to be born here? Does it mean you have to have lived here a certain amount of time or all of your life? What about a student who's only in Leeds for 3 years? What about if you've chosen to live here as opposed to if you've been sent to live here, like our Bangladeshi asylum seeker RJ, who was sent to a detention centre in Wakefield? A guy was interviewed in Bradford who was from South Africa who spoke about choosing gay exorcism and inversion therapy in South Africa, but that was before he came here. Rachel went to talk to a group in Todmorden, and half of the group were from Lancashire who'd come over from Manchester. And they didn't all live there, but they wanted to be a part of it. Do you count these people? And did I mention that half of Todmorden's postcode is from Oldham? And then when we went to make short films about what gay pride means to you, everyone talked about London Pride, and that was in Hebden Bridge. And then we shouldn't forget that, you know, London's queer culture is shaped by people from West Yorkshire as well, because it's a city of queer migrants. And then historically it's even more complicated because the ancient county of Yorkshire had three ridings, north, west and east. And in 1974, the ancient ridings were abolished. So the East Riding, this is why I have to read this bit, right? The East Riding, as we know it today, was not created until 1996. And it includes areas from the West. So Rachel was watching the local news, look north. It took me a while to understand what she was saying when she said that the first time, look north. And there was Louise Jennings, a 99-year-old trans woman on there who was a war veteran talking about how she came out of trans when she was around 70. So we've contacted the news to find her, but yes, she comes from Sheffield, which is now technically South Yorkshire, but it used to be West Riding. Right, so if Sheffield was West Riding, but it's not now, but you were born there when it was, where's your story from and where does it belong? And do you count? And people debate this passionately in the training groups. And one volunteer was worried about the legal ramifications if we got it wrong. Now, you might laugh, but my friends, that in a nutshell is actually what I'm worried about. That we're introducing state-controlled borders into our queer vocab, and that this risks breeding the idea that you're not from these parts, are you? Or what about the one that queers have always been faced with? You don't belong round here, right? And so if you ask me, borders aren't only intrinsically racist, they're also intrinsically transphobic and homophobic. And so I wonder whether or not we question enough what it means to queer a border, what place we have in reshaping these ideas as queers, and what part we should play in unpacking the way we challenge whether or not we need borders at all when we think about local queer histories.
Thank you so much for that too, EJ. You've given us, we've got enough to work off of that to have the questions to continue the conversation. I'm mindful of time and that we've gone over significantly, so I want to just combine the conversation with the audience portion so we can have that be our conversation with everyone as well as the panelists. So if we could have the roving mics ready, if anyone has a question coming out of, I'll take two or three, I think, first of all, and then have the panelists respond to that. Yes, here in the middle.
Hi, excuse me, that was brilliant. I just wondered in this project, and I haven't asked Matt, have you included ethnic minorities in Queer Outside London? Because what I'm finding is that some of us who are queer and Asian, our generations are dying off and just above us. And therefore, you know, these stories, I'm trying to capture these stories. And there were a lot of suicides and things like that. So it's very important in a project like yours. I just wondered how much there was.
Can I ask you to hold the question about Queer Beyond London until Matt and Alison come back up afterwards? But I think the question of including ethnic diversity in local queer histories is a really important one. So we'll certainly have that to the panel as part of the conversation. Other questions, please. We'll get a few together and then return.
My work here is done.
Yeah. Well, let's... Oh, yes. Sasha.
I'm just intrigued. You may have all heard a bit of the talk about the idea of there being a queer museum, the Queer Britain Project, which would be based in London, for one thing. What are the feelings from the panel around the idea of a single receptacle for all of queer history? What are your thoughts on that?
And next to Sasha.
Hi, my question is around what should we be implementing now so that we don't have to retrofit capturing these histories in the future?
Tell me again.
Sorry, what should we be putting into place now to make sure that we're capturing histories from going forward as well as not as well as capturing what's going on before?
Oh, and last one before we return to the panel.
So my question again is on capturing those histories. So one thing that I'm aware of is that as we capture these histories, there's inherently just the gatekeeper aspect of the person capturing the history itself. So what is in place or what is there to put in place to prevent the bias of the group or the organization or the queer museum that is capturing the histories to be making those judgment calls of relevance or importance themselves? And where are we putting in those steps to really capture that diversity?
I think these questions work really well together. Who is capturing the history? What is the future proofing for that? And where is that history going to reside? So these work really well together. And I put these to each of you, whoever would like to make a comment.
Well, shall I start? Matt earlier quoted Ralph Samuels about what Ralph calls counter-knowledge. And I think that's a critically important thing. Knowledge is created by us. It doesn't exist out there. And traditionally, the owners of that knowledge have been history departments or the official repositories of records. What's been achieved over the last, especially the last 20 years, is the creation of alternative archives, which can range from private collections to the increasing number internationally now of LGBT, queer, leather, or bi, or trans museums and archives. And they're often community-based, or at least they begin as community-based. The problem with community-based organizations is they need funding, like everything else, and can easily disappear. And a number of these organizations are now part of universities. So there's an interesting tension there between the intentions of the original collectors of alternative knowledges and the sheer economic necessities of getting the right conditions to preserve the archives. And that's something we're always trapped in. You know, a friend over there asked about queer museum and should there be a queer museum, or how right is it that the idea of a queer museum is based in London? Well, 10 years ago, I was a member of a sort of working group that explored the idea of a queer museum. We met every few weeks for about six, 9 months. We explored different sources of funding. A building even was founded. The fundamental problem we were faced with was how we would acquire this building. Even if we acquired it, there's always good stories about we tap 10 million gay millionaires and they'll come up with the goods. Well, first of all, that's not so easy. Even if they come up with the goods, there's the real fundamental problem of how we run these organizations. If it's going to be a free organization, who's going to pay for that free museum? It doesn't exist in thin air. So in the end, sadly, we disbanded as a group and various other alternative things came up. The idea has been now revived and money is being sought and so on. I just remain a little skeptical. It's going to take an enormous amount of energy. It's going to be heavily revenue intensive to keep it running. And there's always the danger, as the Feminist Archive found in London, where it eventually was taken over by City of London Poly and then London Metropolitan University, and then is now part of the LSE. And there's tremendous controversy about access to that. And that's always the problem. Again, who controls this? I'd like to say the solution is always community-based saving of the archives, whether they're documentary, traditional archival, or oral history. The slight nervous skeptic in me says at some crunch point, there's always a financial problem. And the Hall Carpenter Archive is a classic example of that. I was involved in the beginning in setting up the archive and trying to arrange funding for it in the first place from the then Greater London Council. And the end result was it ended up in the LSE Library. And the LSE Library, unfortunately, always has a say over whoever has access to it. So there are problems with it. Doesn't mean we should give up. And in all sorts of ways, tremendous energy is going into it. But we've always got to be cautious. In the last resort, we need resources to run them. And the LGBT communities in this country are not over-rich with resources. So there's always a problem.
Is there anyone here from Queer Museum? That's my problem with it. And then I guess the other thing would might be that does it let every single large institution off the hook about what they need to do, being inclusive with LGBTIQ audiences? That's it.
Could I ask you, Rachel, just to make a final point about the future-proofing, because that seemed to speak to some of the issues you brought up.
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's a very good slogan in the disability history and arts movement, which is nothing without us, nothing about us without us. And I think one of the things that is really essential is that we are challenging institutions about who is on their board of trustees, who works for them, who has a permanent job there. And great as the tours and the volunteers and things are, it's about making sure that those publicly funded institutions do represent the public they serve at every level. And I am absolutely with EJ that while I can see there are very serious arguments for having a base and, as it were, a ginger group for pressing those issues, an actual building and collections will let the other institutions off the hook, and I don't think that's what we should be doing, and I don't think it's sustainable in current terms. And of course, that's my personal view and not that of the Heritage Lottery.
Thank you to our panel. And if Alison and Matt would just make a final comment.
Thank you so much. That was just, wow, that's a really fantastic discussion, I think, of some of the complexities of this debate around local community heritage and history making. And what really struck me, we are going to release you for a drink in a moment. We're just going to be one more minute. What really struck me was the need, I think, in the future to think really seriously about the different dances, the dance of queer and normal, the dance of local, national, international, dances across borders and indeed dissolving borders, and how we capture that without getting stuck in silos and collections getting stuck in places where they're not being used and accessed. And I think it's only when we do that that we begin to understand the complexities and the layers of identity and identification. And the ways in which the different identifications are embedded in each of us. I was really struck with what Geoffrey said about his Welshness there, and South Welshness, still there in the metropolitan, Geoffrey, we all know. I was thinking too about Ash's question, which is really crucial, because one of the big challenges of Queer Beyond London was precisely that, was finding interviewees who were prepared and were trusting enough to come forward and speak to us. And in fact, we did interview black and minority ethnic people for the project, but there were people that tended to be already vocal in activist groups, in arts groups, and so on, and who were often known already, and their testimonies were fantastic. But it was much more challenging to go further into those communities and to hear those voices. So that's another real challenge, I think, for the future. And I suppose the final point I'd make is that many of these projects are very much based on oral histories and living memory. And we need those histories because that's part of how we future-proof our knowledge of the present moment as well. But there's also a problem with it in that, well, not a problem, we need more than that because we need to go beyond living memory and to those earlier periods. So a lot of the projects that have been really active have done really sterling work in capturing the last 50 years. What's more of a struggle is going earlier than that and going beyond that. And I think that's where there needs to be, I suppose, another focus, another set of projects.
Just a couple of points on, I guess, the more practical issues that have been raised. Not that I've got any answers at all. I mean, it's just such a, you know, it's such a head-banging conundrum, isn't it? The issue of what gets collected and who gets represented in the archives, I mean, is absolutely a crucial one. And I mean, the projects that we have used that were organised in the cities over the last 10 years, they've all been aware of representation of queer people of colour and so on, and non-gender binary people. But you know, there is a huge lack of those testimonies and those histories. And as many queer oral historians have noted, you have to have a certain kind of identity to front up, to want to give your story, to be interviewed, to go along and join the group, to be open to people asking for you to contribute in the community. And so, you know, different the various communities. I mean, Manchester, we had a fantastic turnout of different communities within the broader LGBTQ community when we did our day of a workshop and a public event there. But, you know, those stories are still not necessarily all represented in the archive at all. Anyway, so I don't have any answers, except that, you know, we just have to sort of keep pushing and talking with those communities. And obviously some of that work is now being done, particularly West Yorkshire Queer Stories, as I've seen on your website and Facebook page. the other thing actually, EJ, that you were talking about, the vast quantity of archival material kind of makes one want to, you know, go and hide under the duvet in a way. So, you know, I know I've talked to Rachel about this in the past, and Rachel said, you know, the idea of a gateway into these different digital archives, you know, it's relatively straightforward and simple, but again, you know, as Geoffrey and others have pointed out, it needs somebody to front up with the cash and the resources. But, you know, a lot of these resources are digital, so it's just finding a way in. But I think more than that, and this is my final point, you know, what do we do with them? And those of us who are teachers, those of us who work with community groups and so on, you know, we need to use all this stuff. Otherwise, what's the point? You know, we can use it in different ways, academically, in museums, exhibitions, but and with students in schools, universities, colleges, and so on. So it's really to make a plea that it's not just about collecting all this. And I'm as obsessive as anyone about making sure we've covered every last piece of ground, but actually then using the material with people. And we can all take a part in that, I think.
So it just remains for us to thank, huge thanks to our panel. Huge thanks to Justin for chairing. Huge thanks for you for coming along and listening to us, and to invite you all to join us for a celebratory drink. Thank you very much.